live and on tape from the inner fortress deep in the control center of Beacon Athletics. Welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. On this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, we'll begin a two-part interview looking into some family baseball groundskeeping history.
And in the bullpen, we'll talk about what's involved in pretending to be Jacob's Field. Paul, or should I say Caitlin, what else have you pretended to be?
You're going to have to check out my criminal background for that. On today's Out of the Park segment, we'll talk with Mark Razum, head groundskeeper with the Colorado Rockies, and Tom Burns, former Texas Rangers head groundskeeper and currently working with Diamond Pro. The two will speak about starting out together at the old Cleveland Municipal Stadium on the shores of Lake Erie and their time learning the craft under the watchful eye of late Marshall Bossert of the famous baseball groundskeeping Bossert family.
And in our turf science segment, we'll talk about how skepticism can be your best friend while you're out on the field.
I'm skeptical of that, but I'm going to listen anyways. All of that and more on this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. Well, hello again, everybody. I'm Paul Zawaska, the host of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. And once again, I'm joined by Teresa Beyer, my talented co-host and producer of the show. Welcome, Teresa.
Once again and forever and always, Paul.
Boy, if we do this forever, that's going to be torture.
For our listeners.
Yes, probably. Well, you know, in our last show, where we kind of revisited my years with the Orioles and some of my old crew, I talked about how in many cases your crew becomes your other family because of the long hours, you know, that a lot of us spend that are in the industry we're familiar with. And, you know, the industry demands a lot of our time and often on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Well, the next two shows, we're going to look at a real life family who has had an impact in the ball field groundskeeping industry for about 80 years.
Wow. I didn't realize they had been going that strong for that,
long. Yeah, they're a little shy of the century mark, but I think they'll hit that mark as well. The very people I'm talking about are the Bossards. There have been several Bossards over the past 80 years, starting in I think it was 1935 with Emil Bossert in Cleveland, and eventually his sons Harold and Marshall and Gene. All had their turns there in Cleveland, and eventually Gene would move out to Chicago to take over at the White Sox. And his son, Roger, is the current White Sox head groundskeeper there. So they've all had their time in Major League Baseball. And today's show, we're going to examine how the late Marshall Bossert inspired and groomed Tom Burns and Mark Razum for their careers in Major League Baseball. And so we'll follow up on that in our next show in 2 weeks with an interview with the very man himself, the current Bossert that's standing in Major League Baseball, Roger Bossert from the White Sox.
I'm really looking forward to hearing more about Cleveland. I kind of grew up there. Well, I mean, I visited there a lot while I was growing up. My grandparents lived there and my mom grew up there and obviously my uncles and everything. And so I've got a lot of fond memories of both stadiums in Cleveland. The mustard, for one thing, is fabulous. seriously, it's the best mustard in the world.
Known more than the baseball team at the time.
At the time, yeah. And for most of Cleveland's history, yes. Cleveland has a storied career of winning in championships.
And yeah. mustard.
Yeah. That's why they're known for their mustard.
Well, it's kind of like the special sauce at the old County Stadium in Milwaukee, which they used to, you know, when they sold bratwurst, they used to dip it in this special sauce, which is still used today, if I'm not mistaken, at Miller Park.
Yep.
But, it's always enjoyable looking back in the history of our profession. That's kind of what I like to do with this show is let the young kids today know more about what it was like in the past with a lot of the guys who are still around, and
kids
it's important
these days.
It's important to get their view. So the Bossards are a great example of that. It all started in Cleveland at the Mistake by the Lake.
Oh, I hate calling it that because I just love Cleveland so much, but I understand why.
Apparently you didn't sit in those stands during a football game in December.
No, because I'm intelligent. No, I'm kidding. My uncle did lots of times with paint on his face. We're proud. with that, let's move on into the bullpen. I kind of teased this segment by talking about how you got to pretend that your field was Jacob's field.
Yeah. I want to say that was 93. I can't remember if it was 93 or 94, but it was the first year that STMA held their own conference. Before that period, STMA was always kind of tagging along onto somebody else's conference because we weren't quite that big yet. Mm-hmm. But the first year that STMA held their own conference, it was at my ballpark at Oriole Park. And at the same time, they were shooting, they're at the tail end actually of shooting Major League Two.
Major League Two, yep, came out in 1994. Thank you, Internet.
94. So then it was, does it say when in 94 came out?
It might. I did not click all the way through. I just wanted to see the date.
So that would tell me that it was probably done in
30th of March.
30th of March. Okay.
Is when it was released.
It was filmed
in 93.
They were filming in October and November because we wouldn't allow them into the ballpark until after the season was over to film.
Smart.
And that's a whole other story. You know, that movie almost wasn't shot at our park. And the reason being was at the time, the Maryland Film Commission was trying to get Hollywood to come out and do more movies and television in Maryland.
Ah.
And they had come to the Orioles and asked if they could shoot Major League Two there because they wanted to shoot it at Jacobs. And I forget, there was something going on that they couldn't, either Jacobs wasn't done being built or whatever the heck it was. And so they wanted to use our park because our park they used the designs of our park to build Jacobs. Mm-hmm. Jacobs has a lot of similarities to our park. And the Orioles said, thanks, but no thanks. We don't want you coming in here and screwing up our field and all that kind of stuff. And a couple weeks later, we got notice from the governor of Maryland you will film the movie there. And by the way, you will cut your costs in half for the movie studio.
Wow.
Because we are trying to lure people in here, and we built this stadium for you, and because of that, you are going to do this.
Wow.
So we were pretty much strong-armed into shooting this movie. But the strong-arming got even worse. At one point during the movie shoot, at some point, and I don't recall when, but they kicked me out. Because I was telling them, no, you can't do that, and no, you can't do this. And, you know, media works in an interesting way if you deal with media sometimes. They will, if you tell them no, they'll go find somebody and keep asking the same question until they get somebody to say yes, even though it's not their domain to say that type of thing.
Right.
And that was happening quite a bit. Hmm. Well, I kept telling them, you know, no, you can't. You know, do this and you can't do that on the field because it's going to hurt the field, blah, blah, blah. So finally, they went back to the state of Maryland, and the state of Maryland called up the Orioles and said, you got to get this guy out of here because he's creating problems with shooting this movie. And I got the boot.
Wow.
So I got sent off on a paid vacation. The rest of my crew stuck around because they were working for the movie, mm-hmm. taking care of the field and everything.
And they didn't have the authority to say yes or no.
Well, and I got a call one night while they were filming. They were filming one night, a night game scene, and they had a full house of fans in there for that night. And Ronnie, one of my assistants, calls up and says, hey, Paul, they want to dig up center field and put a camera in the ground. And I said, absolutely not. And then he calls up a little bit later in the evening, and they had been having rain, and the tarp was on, and he goes, they want to bring this big crane out onto the field to take some of these camera shots. And I'm saying, absolutely not. Of course, they did it anyways.
Yeah.
Because I had no power being where I was, and I couldn't stop them. And the guys knew better. They didn't want it out there, but they couldn't stop it either. But
they did the best they could.
It was a nightmare. And then as we got towards the later end of that movie shoot in November, we had the STMA in November. And so we got the movie done. That was back when the STMA typically was held in the fall and not in winter like it is now.
Gotcha.
So we finish up the movie, get it done like a week or two before Thanksgiving. They ruined 15,000 square feet of turf that we had to rip up. Basically, the right field foul territory, the area between the mound and home plate all had to be pulled out. All around home plate had to be pulled out. It's about 15,000 square feet. We pull that out, replace it, put the blankets on it to try and help get the root growth going. And a couple weeks later, we get this really serious ice storm. And with a very thick ice cover. And I remember that storm. And it was on the our shade side was on the first base side in the wintertime. So we never got rid of that ice all through the rest of the winter. Killed all the grass underneath there.
Sure.
And so March came along. We had to pull all that sod back up that we'd put down and take more sand down because now we had to go in with deep cut sod because we're too close to the start of the season and we had to replace all that. And that was our big nightmare of having that movie.
And this is all out of your budget with no compensation because you had to cut costs in half.
The stadium authority didn't want, or the Orioles, the state didn't want the Orioles charging the movie hardly any money because they were trying to lure more movie business. So my bad memory of Major League 2. And I have yet to sit and watch that movie, by the way. I saw the original, but I never looked at the second one.
Oh, it's funny. You're not missing much. I mean, it wasn't bad, but it wasn't great.
So that was the mistake by the lake. That was the mistake by the lake in Baltimore.
by the bay doesn't have the same ring.
So, you know, I'm really excited about talking to these guys now about working in Cleveland. So let's take a break here and we will come back and we will talk to them and get their input on working for the Bossert family. Well, we're into June now, and it's time to start getting your ducks in a row for your late summer or fall ball field renovation work. And the first thing to think about is whether or not your infield skin is working for you. Is it too hard, too soft, too dusty, or too greasy? Is your infield skin low and need more material added to it? Now, in the past, most groundskeepers just guessed at what an infield skin needed and hoped for the best, but not anymore. You can't fix something if you don't know what's wrong with it in the first place. And that's especially true with infield soils. One of the best investments you can make on your ball field is to have your infield soils tested so you know what's in it and where the potential problems may lie. Beacon Athletics was one of the first to offer infield soil testing back in the 1990s and has over 20 years' experience in infield soil analysis and troubleshooting. We can pinpoint the source of your infield skin woes and present a strategy to correct for any issues. We also offer DuraEdge and FieldSaver engineered infield soils, which are computer blended to precise specifications. Start preparing now for the renovation season by submitting your one-quart infield soil sample to us. Call us at Beacon Athletics at 800-747-5985 for more information on infield soil testing. Stop guessing about your infield soils and get the facts. And today's Out of the Park segment, we're going to bring two men together here who started out in the groundskeeping industry in the same place, a monstrous stadium settled on the southern shore of Lake Erie in the city of Cleveland. 35 or so years ago, Tom Burns and Mark Razum were a couple of young men working at that stadium under then head groundskeeper Marshall Bossert, one of the many Bossert's who have populated Major League Baseball's head groundskeeping positions over the past century. What happened there in Cleveland that pushed these young men at the time into pursuing careers in sports field management, and how did Marshall Bossert play a role in it? That's what we want to find out today. So let's welcome Tom Burns and Mark Razum and find out the rest of the story. Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you guys doing today, Paul?
Doing well. We've been dealing with some rain here in Denver lately, but trying to hang in there and battle it through. We've got one more day game today to get us finished with this homestand, so we're looking forward to trying to get it done.
It's likely Tom pushed that up there from Dallas more than
we had We had enough rain in May in Texas to cover the entire state 8 inches deep. So
and kill a drought.
We've got out of a 5-year drought in the space of about 3 weeks.
Isn't that amazing? Five years for a drought, and it's gone in 3 weeks.
Yeah, and hopefully you won't get that, Mark, because I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
Well, we're just about there. We've got another batch coming our way from that hurricane down in Baja Blanca. I think it's called Blanca. So you might be getting some more of that stuff from us. It just seems like the jet stream's just perfect. So we're uphill, so we're sending it all downhill to you, Tom.
Okay, thanks.
So, gentlemen, let's set the stage here by each of you telling how you came about getting a job, first of all, at Cleveland Stadium on the ground crew. Tom, why don't you go ahead first?
Okay. My brother had a bunch of friends that worked at the stadium, basically in the maintenance department, and we used to go down there for football games and before they had a unionized crew. Which actually happened once I started working there full time. And we used to help with the tarps on football games, and you get to watch the game from the field. So it was a pretty cool deal, pretty loosely structured environment, not like the security and background checks and everything they have now. But when I got out of high school in 1976, started working at Ford Motor Company. I was working in the foundry, and they had a huge layoff. And kind of was out of a job and went down the stadium. One of my friends that worked down there told me that they were looking for help. So I went down there, got a job on the grounds crew, making, I think, $4.50 an hour. And rest is kind of history. I enjoyed the work. You know, you get to watch the games, you know, get on the field. It was quite a change from, you know, working in a inside environment, just a foundry job. It's probably one of the worst environments you could work in. we had a great time there. I learned a trade, and it was just fun work. It was hard work, but, you know, it was very rewarding. You got to see the fruits of your labors. You got to watch baseball games and football games behind the scenes and everything, and just meet some incredible people. And, that's where the course started and just kind of put me on a path to choose that as my profession.
And Mark? Mark? Phil?
Good job, Paul.
Started out, I was actually 17 when I started on the crew there. I played high school hockey. My coach was Brian Bossard, who was the son of Harold and, the nephew of Marshall, and the three of them, you know, kind of ran the stadium. But, my dad, I've always liked landscaping. I felt myself getting into like a landscaping type field. I always mowed all the lawns in the neighborhood and everything. So, but I asked Brian for if there's any openings for a job, and called me up, got me on the crew. We laid about 20,000 square feet of sod, old conventional hand small rolls. My first day on the job, and I figured if I could hang with this, but
welcome to groundskeeping.
But I think, like Tom said, I mean, it was a great atmosphere. Harold was an amazing guy. Marshall, of course, Emil, he was retired then, but he'd come around occasionally. But, I think, you know, getting the sod in, after the Browns football season, replacing all that, getting things geared up for opening day. And I think, when the first time I was on the infield, when Marshall was conditioning it, getting it ready for, you know, opening day for the season, and just my jaw dropped. I was like, holy mackerel, I can't believe like you can actually condition dirt this way to get it to play this well. And, and that's kind of what got me hooked. You know, being around professional baseball, professional athletes, seeing that there was a lot more involved in just mowing grass and dragging out dirt. I mean, there was definitely an art to it, definitely, you know, craftsmanship behind it that, you know, just overwhelmed me. And I just loved it ever since then. And just felt, you know, from those early days that, you know, this is where my career was going to be. Cause you know, coming through high school, you don't know what you want to do, where you want to go. And I just knew it from that point.
You know, it was really funny, and I tell people this all the time, it kind of ages us. But when we were there, the only things that went on the field with a tire was a wheelbarrow and a lawnmower.
Nice.
Everything else was done by hand.
Everything.
You know, taking the football field out at the end of the year was done with a sod cutter and a wheelbarrow.
Holy
and then we'd
crap.
Take it up wow. to the track, and then Brian would have a bobcat on the track, like doing donuts and stuff like that with it. but you know, really, that's really when we started. It was really the only kind of mechanized equipment that was there. Everything else was done by hand. I mean, it was so truly a hands-on job, and you learned the basics of doing this stuff. And I think that's probably why we had such a strong foundation in it, is because we know how to do it with no equipment. Right. You know, shovels, rakes, wheelbarrow, you know, hand screening, the dirt, all
this
stuff.
There was no calling in a contractor.
And there were no lasers.
There was no calcined clay at that time. You know, we used it on you know, they had TerraGreen that we used to use on the turf of the football field. And yeah, you know, we didn't use calcined clay on the infield. That was really not the practice then. We used like Mason sand. And it was, you know, the field didn't have a really good reputation for the turf because over the years, because they'd done a big renovation in 1976, so they took all the topsoil out. They lowered the field by like 3 feet.
And this thing
was built on and it was built on landfill.
Oh wow.
And that was the problem, but I'll tell you what, there was no better infield surface in baseball. You know, they knew how to do it. Amel started that. I mean, he pretty much wrote the book on how to do it, and it was a great opportunity to, like Mark said, you know, to learn a trade. And there's a lot of craftsmanship in it, and there's a lot of pride taken in it. So
yeah, I remember teams coming in. That, you know, visiting teams would come in and take like samples of the infield soil because they wanted to replicate it back in California. I remember Jim Fregosi when he was managing California. He was, you know, taking some and you know, Harold or Marsh. I think Harold and Amel, they did quite a bit of consulting in the area, New York, Detroit, those kind of areas to get their infields, and then. Amel's other son, Gene, ran the White Sox. And he moved, you know, away from the family and to Chicago to get the White Sox going too. So, but yeah, like Tom said, just a lot of memories of just all the handwork, bringing down a wheelbarrow full of infield mix, you know, from the shop area, and there's this big long downhill ramp. I don't even know the angle of that thing, but it was pretty steep, and we'd have to basically wheelbarrow maybe, I don't know, 400 or 500 feet, not still a drop. And if the wheelbarrow wasn't like heaping over, Marshall would, you know, get on you like, what'd you bring me a half a wheelbarrow for, you know? And
that sounds like me with my crew.
So he was like, and he, I mean, this guy wasn't a big guy, but he had forearms like Popeye. Just incredibly strong because, you know, he's working with his hands his whole life.
Yeah.
I have a picture of Marshall for that I'm going to put up on the website with this podcast. He's standing over the mound, and he's got the classic, you know, the cigar butt sticking out of his mouth.
But you're right.
When you describe it, you look at him and you think of Popeye when you see it. He's just got arms of steel.
When we used to get in trouble, and stuff like that come in later.
No. So
we used to bribe them with cigars. So, yeah.
We'd stop at the cigar shop and get him a fresh one. He liked Cuesta Reyes was his cigar. Yeah. And he'd
Cuesta
have
Reyes 95.
Yeah, he'd have this old stubby one that's been in his mouth for probably 3 days. And, you know, we'd give him a new one, and he'd throw out the stub, and he'd light up the new one and just, thanks, fellas.
he'd have a cigar that's about an inch and a half long, and he had a lighter that had a flame that was about 4 feet.
And no nose hairs at all.
Yeah. First of all, I got to ask you, so you worked both football and baseball. How did you guys both decide you want to do baseball more than football?
I felt like you're more involved with the team. When the Indians were there, you got to know the players, you got to work with the players, kind of thing. I was more of a baseball guy growing up, I mm-hmm. guess. There's a lot more intricacies with the mound and conditioning the dirt and, those kind of things. I just felt football was, a rectangular piece of grass that, take care of it. The team comes out on Sunday and that's it, but I just felt right. A lot more good interaction with the club and just liking baseball more for me.
And Tom?
Yeah, I have to echo that because, with baseball, the team works out on the field, and they're working out all the time. They're home a lot more. I mean, you go right. through a baseball season, 81 games, last 6 months, football right. season, at the stadium level, they're only there on Sunday. They may come every other week, for at that time it was, 14 games. So, they're really only there, maybe
7 times,
20 times. Yeah. Well, 20 times out of a year because they come in on Saturday. A couple exhibition games. And they do a walkthrough or they have a little workout. But then you have the game on Sunday and that's it. Baseball, I think another thing was that both Mark and I got involved in spring training sites. And, baseball's more of a year-round deal than football. Back then everybody played, most of the places are very few baseball only stadiums or football only stadiums. They're dual purpose places. But baseball just seemed like more of a year round job. And,
sure.
And plus what he said, with the intricacies of, dealing with different surfaces, you got the mound, you got the skinned area. You got the turf areas. It just seemed like more a more rounded job, I guess.
Hmm. Yeah. So
depending where you live, the weather.
Yeah.
Waking up some of those mornings in December, January, just freezing wind coming off the lake.
The mistake by the lake.
Zero, taking off frozen.
I can remember. I remember being out there and shoveling snow off the tarps all night long.
Oh, that. Yeah. As much snow as you got there, yeah.
Yeah. It's bad those days are over.
Yeah. what can you guys tell me, what were the personalities like with both Harold and Marshall?
Harold is more of an outgoing guy. Harold is, as I remember him, and he wasn't really around all that much when I was there, but
sure.
Harold's, he's like, all right, you guys, you can play football on the field today because tomorrow I'm going to work your butts off. And, I'll tell you what, and I'm sure Mark will echo this, the one thing that I learned from them more than anything was how to handle people. There are certain people when you're a manager that you have to coddle. There are certain people you have to kick in the butt. And there are certain people that you just got to give them some direction. And those guys were masters at getting work out of people and knowing who needed what. They were great. The Marshall is probably the best dirt man I've ever met. I don't really think his agronomical knowledge was up to par with maybe Harold's or Brian's. Brian was the kind of guy that would just try anything. I mean, he was really off the cuff and just a very neurotic personality. Marshall is just kind of more of a deadpan guy, and he'd just run these zingers at you every once in a while. And like, you know, when you think he's not listening, he can hear you from a mile away. But, and Harold was just, you know, he's just a great manager of people. He wasn't afraid to get out there and work with you and you know, kid around with you and stuff like that. But I think that's probably the thing that I learned most was, you know, how to handle people and beside the trade aspect of it, you know, you know, learning the expertise of dirt and how to manage it all together.
Mark, yeah, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would echo, you know, those same thoughts. I just learning from them how to treat people. I mean, they were tough but fair. You know, they took care of you. You just came in and it was work, and you know, that's what you know, nothing was easy at times, but you know, you just came in, we worked together really well. Harold almost could have been a big league baseball player from what I heard. He played in minor league ball. He was just kind of one of those tough guys, just the personality. As soon as he walked in the room, I mean, he had that booming voice and just, you know, you knew Harold was in and you felt good about it. You know, Marshall was awesome too. I mean, not as tough, but you know, he'd get you going. Both of them, you know, well respected by the teams and other teams that came in. You know, big star players would come in and know them and treat them really well and respect them all. But very respectful. Just, you know, like I said, tough but fair and just made you want to work. You know, I enjoyed it. Yeah. Like I said, working
exactly.
With those guys.
That's cool.
Would you guys say that or did Marshall in any way help you move on to your next baseball gig then beyond that location?
For me, I wanted to kind of, you know, venture out a little bit, and I can't remember the AAA. It was in West Virginia, and I want to say Wheeling or whatever, but Marshall had kind of made a contact for me to maybe get that AAA job. I had kind of put some resumes out and things, and I ended up going to Arizona, working spring training for the California Angels, and I don't know, Phoenix seemed a lot more appealing than West Virginia at the time.
Hey, so. Some of us grew up near West Virginia.
Sorry, but
that's
I just kind of moved west, you know, and I always thought back then, you know, what if I did do the AAA job and where would I be today and those kind of things. But, you know, when I did move away, I mean, Marshall was basically a phone call away. I know I had some issues, you know, starting out, and, you know, I was young, I was like 20, and wow. I remember calling him and kind of picking his brain and asking him some things and things like that. But, you know, both of them, all of them were, you know, real supportive and mm-hmm. you know, wanted you to move ahead.
Yeah. Tom, did he help you move along?
Yeah, he did. He did, you know, pretty much in the same aspect as Mark. You know, I remember calling, I was out in Arizona, I called Harold, having trouble with my infield and, you know, trying to get it packed down, everything. I didn't have a roller or something. Yeah, he told me, he goes, just get an old pickup truck with bald tires. And he goes, just run it over there until you run out of gas. He goes, it'll pack it down real good. And, I can remember this one field that we did, you know, and we actually tilled it up. We used the native soil that was out there. We tilled it 4 inches deep and had probably one of the ranchers in the area send over some of his workers, and we screened 3 infields 4 inches
wow.
deep by hand.
Holy cow.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I mean, just like Mark said, you know, we did what we had to do to get the job done. And there was no second thoughts of it because that's the way we were trained. That's the way we grew up. And, you know, just, you know, you got a problem. Okay, here's the solution. I'm used to not having any equipment. So, you know, you can make a big screen. You can put it on stilts a little bit, you know, get it up there. And you just, you know, you fill it up. You get two guys shaking it. You move over. And, I mean, we did all those infields like that. And it was... Yeah. It was just something that you had to do.
Yep.
Yeah. No, and I think that was great to have that foundation starting out too. Like, I remember, you know, starting out spring training fields. We do the winter overseeding, and you wanted to top dress at least like the infields. And I just remember getting the guys, and we would just go out there with, you know, wheelbarrows and shovel and broadcast sand to top dress in the seed because we had no access to a, you know,
top dresser,
yeah. You know, mm-hmm. So things like that.
You learned how to do it there.
Yeah. You figure a way out if you don't have, you know, the resources. And yeah, I look back at that as, you know, just learning that hard work ethic and just having that in the back of your mind to get through issues if you can't figure things out.
And really, you know, learning the techniques of top dressing with a big scoop shovel, a grain shovel.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, George Toma learned under Amel, and you know he always tells a story. In fact, when he did when they inducted him in the those two in the Hall of Fame, there's a picture I think of Amel Mark with the old galvanized bucket spreading seed. And I'll tell you what, that guy could spread seed as good as any mechanical spreader. And they taught us how to do that. I mean, you know, there's an art. I mean,
yeah.
You know, we can top dress an entire infield with a grain shovel as good as any top dresser can. Now it's going to take a lot longer, but I mean, but they taught us that technique. They taught us, you know, we used to, and Paul, I told you this, you know, the level board that y'all make, that's how we leveled the infield.
Yeah,
because we had those things that were made in house in the carpenter shop there. They showed the guys how to make them. They made them, and I mean that's what we did. We didn't use a screen drag very much. You know, it's just that, you know, that's the real craftsmanship of taking care of a field.
I still prefer leveling an infield that way with string lines and level boards than I do having a laser grader come in.
But I'm talking about, you know, right before the game.
Yeah,
Yeah, just going back real quick, too, on that Hall of Fame thing with George and Emil. And George was there, and we had some old pictures, and there was a picture of Emil standing next to this brand-new, shiny 48 Buick that the team got him when they won the World Series, and George saw that picture and he's like, oh yeah, Emil tire rolled all the infields at the spring training site. So like I said, no matter what it was, they you know, whether it was a brand new shiny 48 Buick, I mean, hey, if those infields need a tire roll, I'm tire rolling. You know?
That's what one thing Marshall used to always say: if you're raking and you weren't doing a good job, he always tell you don't play with the tools. You know, so, but they, you know, they taught you the proper way to use a tool, and
yeah,
you know, that's you know, it's something that's invaluable.
Yeah, I'm going back too. I remember, I don't know if you remember Tom, but Marshall, you know, we used to broadcast with these like these flat, basically they were coal shovels, like
yeah.
And so like we'd have, you know, our tools, whatever, we'd work, but like when, like before opening day, the media would come down and, you know, want to take photos of the guys working, and Marshall would have me go up to his office and get his brand new shovel out of the back room and bring it down, and he'd have that shovel as when they were taking photographs.
Yeah.
I remember one day going up to the office, and I needed we used to use the level head rakes. And I went up and I grabbed, he had like 40 of them in there. It looked like an Ace Hardware store.
Yeah.
And I walk in there, and he wasn't in the office, so I just walked back and I grabbed one. He comes walking in as I'm walking out, and I go, he goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm getting a rake." "Hey, you can't take those. Those are my good rakes." "Come on, Mark." I said, "We need a rake." talk about, craftsmanship. I've never, ever, ever seen anyone that could water a field as evenly as he could. And he used to have this old, he had this old brass power washing nozzle that was flattened down on the end to just a flat stream.
Wow.
And I mean, that he treated that nozzle like it was his child. And I think Mark and I were like probably the only two people that he ever entrusted that nozzle to. He'd take it off the hose at, the end, and, he'd hand it to one of us or something. And, you could take the nozzle. I used to tell him one day, I'd say, "Hey, Marsh, I got a big Don Diego for you, the cigar, if you hit Bob with the hose, he'd turn right away and just squirt this guy down and hose him down." The other thing, talking about no mechanized things, and Mark will remember this one, he'll never forget this, is we used to haul hoses from center field. These 2-inch or inch and a half Goodyear rubber hoses. I mean, 300 feet of hose on roller base impact sprinklers, and that's how the grass got watered.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
They upgraded to a quick coupler system. That was like the space exploration. it just instilled a work ethic in you that I think, sometimes in our generation is kind of lacking. That's the foundation, and that's why they're successful, and we can never repay them for that.
Well, let me ask you here one last question, and that would be, what are some of your best memories or best stories out of your career there, whether it was with or without Marshall, or the funniest things that happened to you, or just what are some of your favorite memories? I'll let Mark go first.
Oh, man. Yeah. I don't know. I think it was a loose atmosphere, around there. Marshall and Harold were great. I mean, we'd all get along. I mean, back then, I think just being around those guys, I can't think of anything specifically when we start talking. I mean, things come up. I remember, like my first opening day, like I said, after, laying the sod, doing this, doing that, seeing how the, infield's prepared, and we opened against Kansas City that weekend, and just George Brett coming out, and I think he was like maybe in his second or third year then, but just giving Marshall a big old hug and, that camaraderie, and I was just standing there like, wow, there's just a lot of things. I mean, gosh, I remember one of the the Walendas, the tightrope walkers.
Oh,
thinking
yeah.
about that.
We
I remember that story.
He walked across the stadium, like over the field, and we helped set up that 1-inch cable across, and just setting it, getting it all tightened, and just seeing him test it out when we were up there.
That's
without
so cool.
I was just like, oh my gosh, there's no way.
Remember, we were up there, and the storm was there. Was a storm coming across the lake.
I've heard
this
story. Yeah.
Yeah.
And me and Mark are up there. We're screaming down the cover of the field.
Yeah. It was like the heart of thunderstorm, season, and it was humid as heck, and these storms were brewing, and I'm like, this guy's nuts. But I mean, just I could go on and on. I mean, you know, like I said, some of those mornings on December, you know, and Harold come, you know, we're all dragging and, you know, not wanting to be out there, and Harold, you know, the locker room door would come flying open, and he'd be, you know, getting us all fired up, you know, getting us going. Just a lot of good memories. It was a great place to, you know, start your career, and going through all that, I could see how I ended up where I'm at, you know, cause it's just a great environment.
Tom, anything to add to that?
I'm sure you got a few stories. Yeah, some of them I can't tell on the radio.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Well, but, yeah, that's why I'm keeping it G-rated.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
one of the funniest ones I think I've ever seen before is that I ever experienced. We were in a game, and we used to sit down by the bullpen. And Marshall, you know, the phone rings, and Marshall runs in there, and he's got this real serious look on his face. It was, you know, threat of rain and stuff, and he comes out and he looks at me. I said, "Marsh, who's that?" He goes, "The weatherman." He goes, "It's around us on all three sides." And I was like, "Marsh, what are we living in, a pyramid here or what? Or a triangle?" But that is just so funny. You know, it's just around us on all three sides. I said, "Well, I thought the thing had four sides to it." Anyway, just little things like that he was just so funny. And you know, but he really genuinely cared about you, and you know, we had a great time. I mean, it was Caddyshack with professionalism, because when we were off, we used to cut up, and I mean, you talk about practical jokes being played on people, and just there's a little, you know, a little infighting every once in a while, but when it came time to work, everybody pulled together, and just, you know, they got the job done. And I mean, it was some of the most fun I've ever had in my life. You know, like I said, I can remember shoveling tarps off. We had the, I think it was 19, it was either 80 or 81. They had the strike year in baseball, and they had, so they settled the strike, and it was already football season, exhibition season. So Thursday we had a game against the Pirates. They had a couple exhibition games to warm up to start the season again. And then so Friday we had to start changing over to football because we had an exhibition game with the Steelers on Saturday night. And then Sunday was the All-Star game, which happened to be in Cleveland, and that was the start up to the second half of the season. So Chuck Knoll was in there, and he wanted to work out on the field. We had rain coming, and I remember covering the infield. A big storm came up. We covered the infield with a football tarp. We had 10 guys, and that's basically what we had. And we could get the field covered in 90 seconds.
Wow.
This football tarp was off the ground. Wind was blowing so bad.
Was it back then, Tom?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Big green ones. When you dump that in an August thunderstorm, the steam coming off it would just kill you. And mosquitoes. But anyway, so we got that in, and then we had the All-Star game. You know, we worked all night long. The lights are on, and at like 2:30 in the morning, Dan Coughlin, one of the sports writers, comes, you know, saw the lights on, and, you know, somehow I guess he looked in the stadium and saw us working everything. He comes back with like three cases of beer for us.
Aww.
And that was something that was, I mean, I thought that was just the greatest thing. And so, you know, we just, I remember a bunch of us stayed at my house because I lived real close. We were there till like 3 o'clock in the morning. The next morning, you know, we're there at eight, we're back at 8 o'clock, got the All-Star game in. And it was, you know, things like that. It's just, you know, it was just a great time. It was really hard work, and we were all, you know, moaning and stuff about how much we were working, but I'll tell you what, I'd do it again in a heartbeat. It's some of the fondest memories I've ever had were at that place.
Well, yeah, definitely.
It's a lot like I talked about in my last show a couple of weeks ago when I did it with my former crew, you know. These people become your second family because you spend so many hours together, and it's because of that you get such camaraderie, and it's what makes work fun. And you know, I've always said that that job kept me young because you worked hard.
Oh yeah.
But you messed around just as much, because and my guys knew as long as the work was done, they could screw around all they wanted. But my guys knew when it was time to get the work done, you got the work done, it's the greatest job in the world.
That's
although
the
it's
line.
Getting a lot tougher these days.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I really appreciate you guys taking time out of your day today to talk about your time back there in Cleveland and getting started in your career and working with the Bossert family, and which is kind of what we're centering on. And I really appreciate you guys talking a lot about them today, and appreciate you coming on the show. Great to hear a lot of these fabulous stories.
Well, thank you, Paul. I appreciate it. It was kind of cool to revisit this stuff today, and I appreciate your ideas and putting this together. It was great to talk to Tom and you guys as well about you know, all these things. I mean, we could probably spend about 5 hours talking about it. But it was
that's the after show.
Yeah, it was fun to revisit, though. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I appreciate it too. And yeah, I think it's a story that needs to be told. And I just really appreciate it. It brings back a lot of fond memories to me. And enjoyed spending the time with y'all today.
The history of this industry is important, and it's key that us older groundskeepers get this information out to the younger groundskeepers so they know where this industry came from and how hard we worked back then to get where they are today.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Greatly appreciate it, and hopefully we'll be talking to you again soon.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you. For all of you Diamond Da Vincis out there who are busy this time of year painting your fields, whether it's for baseball, soccer, or the upcoming football season, Beacon Athletics can help you complete your on-field masterpieces. We have a full offering of string lines, stencils, templates, paint machines, and paint. Beacon can provide custom field stencils to promote your organization, club, or school. Then, to paint it, we offer various bulk paints like Beacon's own Dazzle line, or try the likes of World Class or Combi Premium paints with many vibrant colors available. For touch-ups, we also have World Class and Goal Line brand aerosol turf paints. To apply your bulk paints, Beacon carries the top-of-the-line Graco Field Laser S100 or the Powerliner 850 Airless Line Sprayers. These gas-powered machines can handle the big jobs, but for the smaller jobs, we also have the battery-powered Field Laser S90 and the Combi. So let your creative imagination run wild. Check our web store at www.beaconathletics.com or call our experienced sales staff at 800-747-5985 and let us help you with your brushes, paint, and palette to bring your masterpieces to life.
Hey, Paul.
Yes?
Do you remember in our first episode when I asked Eric from Los Angeles, I asked him if he'd been seeing more salesmen popping up who are pitching what I like to call magical products?
Shazam! I do remember that.
Well, you know, he said he's pretty good at filtering them out and all of that, and it's kind of nice to be, you know, sitting in a major league stadium and have that ability. But yeah, a lot of folks don't have that chance, and their salesmen come in. Sometimes even their trusted salesmen will have a new product that they're selling that just seems. I always think that they seem too good to be true. Do you know what I mean? Did you ever run into those?
All the time, and you know, nowadays, of course, compared to when I was in the business. I didn't have the internet at the time to be able to look at that kind of stuff because the internet was coming in more so when I was coming to the end of my career.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have those resources. Nowadays, you've got those resources. But there was lots of times where I thought to myself, man, I wish I could ask somebody who I know is going to tell me the truth about something than relying on. Now, you know, I had salespeople that I stuck with because I know they would tell me the truth,
yeah,
whether it was about their own products
mm-hmm.
or somebody else's.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did with salespeople. When I had those kind of people, I hung on to them because
yeah.
I knew that they would always give me a straight answer.
Well, and the other part of that, having been on the sales and marketing side, is sometimes even your most trusted salesperson is being fed a line and doesn't doesn't know that.
Right.
They're being given information that, you know, may or may not be up to snuff, you know? And so I want to go into this with a caveat. I'm not trying to say never trust a salesman or, you know, anything like that. But I do want to talk a little bit today about being a skeptic, about different ways that our listeners, if they're not familiar with the process already, some different ways to think through about whether or not they think they're getting a magical product or a real product.
That sounds like a good idea. I think that's something that everybody would love to know.
Well, we'll hope so. And if not, I'm sure we'll hear about it.
You got that right.
Yeah, that's true. So, okay. Basically, one of the things that I don't think a lot of people know, and this is something I learned from working in the industry, unless it's a pesticide. So if we're talking about a fertilizer or what they will call a growth enhancing product, which is different than a plant growth regulator like we think of for like Primo and, mm-hmm. and those sorts of things. That's a whole nother subject I can get into another time. But when we're just thinking about these growth enhancers, and you'll see that term used a lot, or fertilizer.
And there's a lot of them out there.
Yeah, there are a lot because there's very little regulation in the United States for that. It's actually one of the things that I do as part of my consulting business is I do provide basically a report for my client on any product that they're interested in. And I'll go through basically the process that I'm going to talk about today and go a lot more extensive, and I give a write-up about it, showing the pros and the cons. I find the science behind it, and we go through all that together and talk through it. But it's stuff that can be done on your own. I'm not doing anything that's magical. The only difference is that I've got a little bit more experience from the marketing and the science side to look for what I call trigger words.
Right, exactly.
But we'll get into that here in a second. So the first step is to decide whether or not you think your product might be a magical product. I always call them magical because they make all of these wild claims. They make too many claims, or they make a claim that's just a little too perfect to your current situation,
yeah.
or too fantastical.
Or too good to be true. Yeah, yeah.
Or just for any reason, if it hits your gut and you go, well, I'm not sure, then that's probably a good indication to go ahead and check it out. Or at least talk to somebody else in the industry and say, have you heard of this? Have you heard anything about that? One of my favorites is when it's just a little too perfect for your situation. That's usually an indication that they're making a ton of claims. And the more things that something, there are very few things out there, if any, that can do 20 different things from Sunday. Generally, it's either going to give you plant health benefits, or it's going to give you a fertilization benefit, or it will affect your roots, or it will affect, you know, your soil or any of that. It very rarely does all of the above.
Sure.
Yeah. Originally, I had that further down in the list, but I wanted to bring that up to number one. I think going with our gut is a good place to start. So the next thing I would do, and this is a little bit harder to do on your own if you're not familiar with the process, but you can get online and you can start looking for different articles about this product. First, you pull up their marketing information and verify, you know, what they're saying. So you go to their own website. If they don't have a website, big red flag. If they have,
especially today, you know.
Yeah. If they have a cruddy looking website, big red flag. If all they talk about is marketing, if that's all that they give you is marketing information and it's really hard to find a label on their website, big red flag. It means that that's a really good indication that they might be trying to pull something over on you. They don't want to give you too much information. They want you to try to base all of your decisions based on as little information as possible. So what can you find about this product on its own website? And then what can you find online? How many other articles are there, like in Grounds Magazine or Sports Turf Magazine, even in the golf course side of things, any of that? Can you find more articles about this product? The more you can find, the more likely it is that you've got something that's either been well discussed, well studied, or well used. And so it's less likely to be a magical product, which is kind of neat. The next part is looking for scientific literature. And this can be tricky if you're not used to it. There are some good online sources. Scholar.google.com is where you would start this search. And
it's one of my favorite sites.
Well, as science nerds, we love this site.
that's my point. I mean, nobody's going to know about that.
That's right. Yeah. Well, which is why I wanted to share it with everybody today. And you would go there, and actually, if the product is called, let's say, Turf Extraordinaire, that's not what you're going to want to look up on scholar.google.com. You'll want to go to the label and look for what we call the chemical name. For instance, I mentioned Primo earlier. Primo is the marketing name, and Trinexapac ethyl is its chemical name. So you would actually want to do Trinexapac ethyl instead of Primo, because scientists insist on using the chemical name, and for good reason, so that there's no confusion. Sure. But that would be where you would start looking for the scientific literature and trying to see if there have been any university studies. Now, this is a key here, because on their own website, they might cite some university studies or some studies that have a university link to it. Click through on those. If they don't click through, that's suspect, because they don't want you to see the work. So they might be hiding something. The other thing you want to do is look and see if there are any field work along with the greenhouse studies. You'll see a lot of greenhouse studies because those are easy to do. They're inexpensive to fund. But it also won't show you how well the product works under real life conditions. And those real life conditions are what's important. Just because it was studied in a greenhouse doesn't mean it doesn't work in the field. But having field work on top of a greenhouse study will help a lot as far as knowing exactly what you can expect from a product, if anything that you can expect. And from there, whether or not, and now we're really diving into the science at this point. So this is where it kind of helps to have someone on your side that knows more about this, but looking to see if they have a larger plot versus a smaller plot, and what kind of statistical analysis was used in that. But that's really getting into it.
And sometimes they'll do, you know, the plots won't necessarily be on a research, on an academic research facility either. They might do it out at a ballpark or a stadium or some other athletic facility quite frequently, which really is real life.
Yep.
You know, as what you're looking for.
Yep. And darn near impossible to find. But when you can find a test that does that, that's pretty fun. Yep. The other thing to look at, just from their own website, not even diving into the science and the scientific literature on that, is whether or not they're giving you quantitative or qualitative measurements. A qualitative measurement is color, appearance, anything that you can't go out and take.
Measure.
Well, I hate to say that, because when you look at color, we have a sliding scale for color now, but it's still objective. It's still left to the researcher. For the most part, if they're not taking measurements with machinery or tools, you know, other than the human eye, that's going to qualify as a quality or a qualitative measurement rather than a quantity or quantitative measurement. Sure. Quantitative measurements are less biased. And so then the last part of this, and the very last thing, and then we'll get going, is what marketing claims are they making? And this comes from my background in marketing. I actually worked in the tech service department and worked with marketing to make sure that they were using the correct words and not going outside of their scope. It's interesting, because to a scientist, a word means one thing in particular, but to an English student, you now have your thesaurus and you can start looking up similar meaning words. But from a scientific point of view, that little shift in that word and its precise meaning can make a big difference. So that's where we come into those red flags. There are certain words that I look for that are giant red flags. And one of the biggest ones is whether or not they're using a forceful or a definitive word or forceful definitive language. Scientists don't do that. And the more forceful the marketing claim, the more definitive the words that they're using, the less likely it is that they are working with a science team. And again, that doesn't mean that they're wrong. It just means that there's less likely to be science backing up what they're doing. And the other part of that, and this is something I learned working for the larger companies, is that the bigger your law department, the less likely it is they're going to let you make those claims. Because lawyers don't like definitive language either.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, if nothing else, you know that if they have their own lawyer or their own group of lawyers, you know that they've got money to be able to back up their product should there be a problem. And that's always nice to know. So anyway, these, you know, it's tough to be able to say one way or the other what works and what doesn't work or anything like that. But these are just some really good steps that we can take on our own to kind of decide if we think that a product has a red flag or if it's something that we can feel comfortable trying out on our fields.
It's a good tool for separating the wheat from the chaff. Let's just say.
There you go. That's good.
The fluff from the truth.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely.
Very good. All right. Well, you know, where were you 10, 15 years ago when I was still in Major League Baseball and I needed those kind of services?
Well, I was there and I was visiting you, but I wasn't as good at this as I am now.
That's what working in the corporate world of science will do for you.
That's the truth.
Oh. Well, that about puts this show, I think, in the books.
Yep, I think it does. It was a good show.
Yeah,
really
a lot of great,
excited to see what everyone thinks about it.
Yep. So be sure to tune in next time here to the Diamond Da Vinci's show for more talk about ball field groundskeeping. And the best part is it's all free, you see, because that's the kind of deal we're striking up for you. Because, you know, I can't bear to run into one of you guys listening at the trade, one of your listeners at the trade show, and you scream, "You're ripping me off." So we don't charge for that very reason.
Our official webpage for the show can be found at beaconathletics.com/podcast. There you can find our show notes, where we'll include any paper or links or photos that we might discuss during an episode. We'll also have our pictures and bios up there if you're curious to find out just who it is you're listening to if you haven't met us before. And we'll also throw up some bonus material from time to time if we think it'll be interesting for you guys to see.
And we'd love to hear from you.
We'd love it.
Yes, we do. You can email Teresa and I at podcast@beaconathletics.com, where you can send us your questions or comments, good or bad, about the show. Or if you have show ideas, go ahead and send them along to us as well.
And if you're on Twitter, our Twitter handle is @DiamondDaVincis. That's @DiamondDaVincis. We're not crazy active there, but we do like to share things, and we'll use some of the same links or some different links, especially while we're preparing the show. We might see some stuff there that you won't get on the show.
The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. And with that, we are out of here.
Adios, guys.